RSN Summer Breakfast Club with Nick Quinn and Glenn McFarlane.
We're about to turn our attention to Sri Lanka versus England, and we've got one of the best in the business to have a chat, Tim Wigmore, the author of The Best, How an Elite Athletes Are Made, which is a book out now. So make sure if you enjoy this chat here with Tim, you jump online and put in an order for that book. Tim, thanks for having a chat, and it's so good to be talking cricket as England prepare to take on Sri Lanka.
Cheers, guys. Yeah, it should be an interesting series. Obviously, England missing some key players, you know, no Ben Stokes, Jofra Archer, no Moeen Ali probably for both tests, given his COVID situation. So England will be hard-pressed to repeat their performance their last time when they won 3-0 in Sri Lanka in 2018, which was a very good result.
Now, Glenn McFarlane just said that the current England team that we're about to see take on Sri Lanka could be quite different to the side we might see in a bit over a year when they take on the Aussies in the Ashes. What are you hoping to see from England here? And is there a player or two you think might have a big series?
I think for Sam Curran, it's a big series. He's probably going to get the chance to bat at number 7. And obviously, you know, important bowler as well. You know, he's been around for a couple of years now, and actually played well Ashes Test and did pretty well in England. But I think England would like a left arm. They'd also, you know, like him for his runs down the orders. I think it's a big series for him. We're going to see a debut for Dan Lawrence at 5, and he scored a century for England Lions against Australia at the MCG about a year ago. And his team is very exciting. His technique, very kind of leg side, so not kind of the traditional England way of playing. So he's an exciting player as well. And kind of as ever with England, it's a case of, you know, you've got Anderson and Broad, two fantastic bowlers, but you're also trying to build for the future. So there's no Jofra Archer in Sri Lanka. Markwood is in the touring party. I think he'll play at least a test in England. You know, England really want Markwood to be playing 2 or 3 tests in Australia in a year's time alongside Jofra Archer.
Tim, the English have been obviously in Sri Lanka for probably six days longer than the Sri Lankans and have seemed to have settled in okay, but it's been really difficult with the biosecurity bubble. Is it right that they were confined to their room for the first 3 days and have only played the one sort of intra-club, if you like, trial match?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And on Moeen Ali, like he's been, you know, confined to his room the whole time because he tested positive for COVID on arrival. So it's been a weird start. And in England, actually, not only that, they played this kind of intra-squad game and it seemed to be a bit of a green seamer, which Sri Lanka have a habit of doing this. So they do these green seamers in warm-up matches and then you get to Gore and it's going to be a raging turner, I'm sure.
Unfortunately, COVID is affecting the world, but especially in England, where it's been quite devastating. How important is it for the national team to perform and perform well to give the fans a bit of a distraction from what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of players have talked about that. You know, it is pretty grueling at the moment. You know, obviously, COVID's hard, the weather is miserable. So a lot of players have talked about the kind of responsibility of, you know, the hope that they can provide some sort of joy for English fans back home. Yeah, I think there is a responsibility on England and, you know, hopefully we'll see them play in an attacking style of cricket, which actually was really their formula last time in Sri Lanka. So they actually, you know, they used the sweep very aggressively to really attack Sri Lanka's spinners, and that was quite a low-scoring series. England won all three tests. That'll be interesting as well, whether England play in that style of cricket. And also, you know, without Ben Stokes, he's such a talismanic player, that leaves, you know, that's really taking two players out of the side. So having him cope without him is always going to be a real challenge for them.
You talk about Gore being a potential spinner's paradise. It has been historically. Where is the English team at with their spinners at the moment? I'm sort of throwing forward to what's going to happen at the end of the year when you come out here to Australia. Is there a bit of a concern with spinning ranks in England at the moment?
Yeah, like it's not a new issue, but there is a big concern. So actually, if you look at all the test nations in the world, the last 5 years in first-class cricket, there's actually a lower percentage of spin bowled in England than any other country. So there's a real lack of spin being bowled, and that goes back to, you know, you have lots of games the start and end of the season. You're often playing on these kind of seeming wickets, matches which aren't a lot like test wickets, is the old problem of county cricket. So the number one spinner is John Best at the moment. He's a young kid. He is improving, but he's played 10 test matches, 19 wickets, average of 40 odd. You know, that's not a great record. It's obviously you look at the record of overseas spins in Australia, obviously Ashwin's doing well at the moment, but in general it's very difficult for overseas spins in Australia. And that actually is why England, they wanted to bring, and they still want to bring Adil Rashid back into the side, you know, because you have a leg spinner in Australia, and I think that's seen as a better bet than a finger spinner, which is probably either going to be Don Best or Jack Leach. Jack Leach has actually done slightly better than Best, not as good a batsman, despite what you might remember about his role alongside Ben Stokes in Leeds. But yeah, it looks like it'll be either Best or Leach who's up at the Gabba at the end of this year, unless Adil Rashid can come back into the side, which I think would be a better thing for England.
Tim, Joss Butler's a fascinating player. His test average, just 33.93. We know what a brilliant player he is in shorter games. Can he convert that form to test match cricket? And if he gets hot, how vital would that be for England?
Yeah, so Joss Butler, there was a lot of talk about him last summer. Was he kind of near the end of his test career? But he had a very, very good summer. He averaged 51, I think, which was his best performance in a home summer. Got a big century in the last test against Pakistan as well. So there's a feeling with Butler that he is kind of cracking test cricket. It's one of those, you see him in white ball cricket. He's just obviously such a fantastic talent. Hasn't transferred as well so far. I'm optimistic that we'll see the best of Butler in test cricket. And he hasn't played an Ashes test in Australia yet. I actually think in Australia he's got the tools to go well. He's a big one for England. Obviously, we've also got the return of Johnny Bairstow, but he's going to bat at three. He didn't play a test last year at all. So he looks like he's going to come back and bat at three as a specialist batsman. It's a big challenge for him as well. So England's really kind of a reflection of their other batsmen come in, generally not done too brilliantly, although, you know, some of the recent guys have gone pretty well, such as Dom Sibley. But there's a real feeling that Bairstow kind of had too much hand to be left on the sidelines. So England are going to keen to give him one final crack at test cricket.
Tim, Jack Cullis was appointed a batting consultant last month, heading forward to this series in Sri Lanka. What sort of impact do you think he could have for the group?
Well, yeah, it's a good question because obviously you get a legend like him coming in, but, you know, they always say you're just coming for one test series. There's a limit to what you can do. You know, probably the time where you can do most on someone's game is probably before a series rather than during it. And he's only had, because of quarantine and COVID, he's only had, I think, 5 or 6 days of working with the players for the series. One of the reasons he was recruited on a short-term basis is his record in Asia is very good. And England obviously trying to, you know, find a way of being more successful there. Because, you know, you've got to say England have got four tests in India after this. And India at home are a fantastic side. So that could be a really tough series for England. So, yeah, if England don't go well in Sri Lanka, the kind of sense will be that they could be in for a long, long tour in India.
Tim, who are you tipping to win the first test? And which batsman do you think might lead the way for their prospective team?
Oh, yeah, good question. I think the first test, it could be a nip and tuck. Sorry, that's sitting on the fence a bit. I'll go for England narrowly if I have to predict one. For England, I think we'll see some runs for Johnny Bairstow. He's often been at his best when he's kind of come back and had a point to prove, got a century in Sri Lanka last time. But I think he'll go well for Sri Lanka. Kanaratna, the opener, I think, yeah, he got a century last test in South Africa. I think he's a solid player. I think he'll go well. And, you know, obviously opening in Sri Lanka can be quite not a bad time to bat before the pitch is sort of really, really taking turn.
And Tim, you just released a book named The Best, How Elite Athletes Are Made. Tell us about the book and where can we get our hands on it?
Yeah, so it's almost like a Freakonomics for sport. So it's explaining the factors that make elite athletes and then how they adapt. So looking at everything from why young siblings do better at sport to actually how you hit a cricket ball in 0.5 seconds and why athletes choke. Interviews with athletes from Mike Hussey, Pete Sampras, Steph Curry, Marcus Rashford, so a host of top athletes. It's out now in good bookshops in Australia and obviously online to order as well.
Tim, give us a snippet. What was one aspect that one of the athletes told you and you put in the book that you found quite fascinating?
So there's a good chat with Pete Sampras and his coach as a kid. Basically, he would get ready to serve and as he was throwing the ball up, the coach would shout at him, line for doing a serve down the line or body for into the body serve or wide. And basically the way his coach did that meant that Sampras on those three different types of serve, they all looked identical to the opponent. That was a really nice little tip from him, actually. Quite a good kind of piece of advice for probably young kids to put into action as well. And I think the reason why that's so important is similar in cricket as well, like with bowlers, is if you can have an action in which it looks identical depending on what serve you're doing or what ball you're about to bowl, that makes you so dangerous. And we see it in cricket similarly, you know, the best fast bowlers actually, when you can't tell from the action whether it's going to be a Yorker or a bouncer, well, that means the batsmen don't have cues to react, and it's so difficult. It narrows that point of that window that your opponent has to react.
Well, Tim, my wife owes me a Christmas present still, so I might get her to jump online and order that book for me now as well, because that does sound quite fascinating, and I love hearing what goes into the cake to make those athletes so very special. Tim, thanks very much for having a chat. Enjoy the England series against Sri Lanka, and best of luck with the book. The author of the book is Tim Wigmore. The book is The Best, How Elite Athletes Are Made, and jump online and get it now. Thanks very much, Tim.
Cheers.
There's Tim Wigmore taking a look at the upcoming test between England and Sri Lanka. Quinny, does sound quite fascinating.
I know that you like to make money. Look at this. Look at the odds in regard to this. You're talking about Tim thinking that the English team will win. $2.40 England, $2.70 for Sri Lanka, and the draw, $3.50. Now, we don't generally have draws there, so it might be worth taking that $2.40.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned that they don't have draws between these two teams very often. And looking through the recent history between these two teams,
you're going to prove me
the
wrong
last
here.
26 tests in Sri Lanka have resulted in a result.
There you go.
So 26 right. tests have been one of the teams winning the match.
So let's discount the $3.50 draw, particularly on a turning wicket.
Well, I haven't looked at the weather, but yeah, you'd
bit
think,
of rain, I think, is
think
forecast.
That. So Sri Lanka's won 14 and the visiting team has won 12. I have noted that England have drifted, though. They were as short as $1.60 for this test. They're $1.60 to $2.40, so the money has been for Sri Lanka. Mm. I know Scott Cooney was planning on backing Sri Lanka.
He
said it last week on RSN. So obviously he's just pinned back those broad shoulders and had a bet.
Their form, I mean, I know that it was in South Africa, but their form was pretty average. But I'll tell you what, I might just watch this one. There's plenty of other things to bet on. Might back the Aussies. Remind me later to read you. The Aussies haven't lost a test at the Gabba since 1988. I think it was against the West Indies. Remind me to tell you later on about the West Indies team of the time.
I'll do that.
It was extraordinary.
Well, they're $1.45, the Aussies, to take out the deciding test against India starting tomorrow morning. We're going to take a short break on RSN. Welcome back to RSN, and we're going to speak to one of the superstars of Australian sport, Jack Hale, the fastest man in our great country's history after he smashed a 100-yard record that stood since 1966. Jack, thanks for having a chat, and well done.
No, good morning. Thanks so much.
Now, let's face it, times and records, so very important. We know it's all about winning and whatnot, but have you always got one eye on the clock, and is this something you did set out to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. Always one eye on the clock, especially when it's not a major event where placings aren't as important and times come a bit more into play. And I suppose I really haven't set out. I think it's my first ever sort of 100 yards run. It's a bit of an obscure distance. It's a 2021, so they generally run it once a year. And I actually entered a couple of days prior. It wasn't something super planned, but I knew I was in relatively decent shape, so I was sort of backing myself into something quick. And we did say before the race 9.4, because that would equate to about a 10.1, 10.2 100 metre run.
Well, that's quite incredible, and you got the job done very nicely there in a time of 9.43, so well done. Now, it's been a fascinating journey watching your career. You burst onto the scene as a 16-year-old and unfortunately just missed the Rio Olympics by 0.05 of a second. You're so very hungry to get to Tokyo. How hard has it been with Tokyo postponed, or has it maybe been a blessing in disguise for you because you've got an extra year to get bigger and stronger and you're running some great times at the moment?
I think the positives and negatives are sort of neutralised for me, because at the end of the day, it's a negative in the fact that I was in very good shape last year and was obviously sort of on the road to definitely qualify. But it's a positive in the sense that I'll be 23 next year. Another year. I'll obviously put in a lot of hard work over the lockdown period to get myself to the point where I'm at now. So I think it's somewhat a blessing in disguise that I've had the capacity to train and to actually put in the work, because I think it's going to be very evident with people that haven't really, they've taken their foot off the gas maybe a bit too much over the last year. I think that's going to be very evident coming into this year, and I think that's something that we vowed not to do in March, April, is sort of take our eyes off the side of the major target, and that was Tokyo. So it's been a positive because I think it's given me that extra year to sort of back myself into training and have no distractions race-wise.
Jack, just in terms of Tokyo, there's obviously been a recent spike in Japan. How confident are you that that Tokyo will go ahead later this year? And have you had any information about whether the athletes might be in line to get the COVID vaccines as well, probably a little bit earlier to assist with going over there?
Yeah, on the vaccine stuff, I've heard some things. I haven't read anything directly, but a few guys have said they've read some things around prioritising Olympic athletes going forward for international travel. And I suppose on the Olympics itself, I don't know. Like, I'm trying to stay as positive as I can with it, but it's getting a bit harder and harder with seeing what's going on. Hopefully, vaccine-wise, come July, August is going to be in a much more developed spot. So I'm staying positive. I'm sort of a 75-80% chance of it going ahead, but that obviously changes day by day.
Fingers crossed it does. That nine figure is obviously deep in your mind. You're obviously really fit and ready to go at the moment. How confident are you that getting to Tokyo and to getting into that nine figure for 100 metres and doing that this year?
Yeah, I'm very confident of a PB. Very, very confident. And that my PB at the moment is 10.12. So I think coming into that 10.0, and the thing with this sport is it's somewhat a law of averages in the sense of I can run 10.0 four or five times. If I run 10.0 four, five, six, five, something like that, there's going to be a nice day where things align and that 9 seconds does happen. So my real goal for next year is to, well, for this year, this season, is to be a consistent 10.0 runner who can then sort of throw out a 9.9 when conditions align. And obviously the goal has been over the last few years just to improve on that time by 0.1 every year, and that's something that I did last year. So I think it's more than achievable this year.
Jack, when you get the schedule, you obviously have a training program that's going to result in you peaking and spiking on certain days at the big events. With so much uncertainty, has that had a domino effect on your training?
It's really weird because with the new system and qualification and things like that, you sort of have to target some of these earlier events to get some times out there already. So for me, we're gonna try and sort of line up one of the early races that everyone will be at this year, because Nationals is in April. So we've decided we're gonna have one fast run in February and then obviously line everything back up for April, just to sort of go to that qualifier straight away of 10.05. Obviously, as we know, the new system in place allows for the top 56 to go to the Olympics as well, but that 10.05 just sort of solidifies your spot. And I think you're very right in the sense that there's so much uncertainty around it. So to get that sort of done quickly is what we're looking to do.
Quinny talked a minute ago about Rio and how close you were and how tantalisingly close it was to getting to Rio. What would it mean to you to get to Tokyo and to perform to your level there? And how much does it drive you, that Rio near miss?
I mean, it's been my life for the past
five
years. So I've worked incredibly hard for it. And I think it'd mean everything to me at the end of the day. If I can qualify, not only qualify, but compete well at the Olympic Games. I think qualification for me was sort of something that I looked at 2-3 years ago as sort of that major goal, but I think I'm sort of past that point now where I really want to go and perform well. And performing well for me means a top 12 spot. So that through to the semis and then do well. And obviously, if the final happens, the final happens, but those goals sort of chop and change in the next Olympics as well. So that for that first one for me, it's going to be make a semi-final and run well.
Jack, the superstar and the greatest of all time, Usain Bolt, holds the world record with a time of 9.58. Now, you're running just 0.4 of a second off that. When you say it like that, you sound very, very close. What's the difference between the times you're running and the greatest of all time? What are some of the little things, apart from his magnificent speed, that goes into just closing down those differences and little things that can make such a big difference in slicing 0.1 of a second off your time?
Yeah, I think, obviously, he's just worlds above anyone that's really ever done it. We're talking this bloke was winning Olympic finals by 2-3 metres. Like, that's sort of just unheard of in any fine sport like this. I suppose with my training wise, the little things that happen is just natural development for one. And I think the consistency to the little things, such as a very good gym program, is something that I've seen. Like, I moved to Melbourne in 2017 at 62 kilos. I'm now 74 kilos. We've sort of cleaned up everything outside of training when we get to training and how professional I am with what I do. And I think we sort of look at a couple of values setting up everything we do at training, and that's always going to be robustness, so having the capacity to stop and change things, and then professionalism. So without going into any boring detail of training, it's just having that consistent work ethic over the years, knowing that Olympics is every 4 years in a cycle, obviously this year 5 years, but not really losing sight of that main goal for me has been the biggest one going forward, because I've been able to double up my training loads. I've been able to layer training years on training years, and where I haven't been injured. So that's been the biggest thing for me. It's just been consistency with the last 5 years and what's happened. And if I stay consistent to hard and smart work, there's no real reason I shouldn't improve.
Jack, just in terms of some of your competitors overseas, have you been in contact with some of your rivals and the like over there about whether they've been able to get the training in that you've been able to get? And could it be a huge advantage that here, from a COVID perspective, there hasn't been, you know, you've been able to train as much as you possibly can, whereas, say, in England or the like, it's been lockdown central over there, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, I haven't really talked to any of the international competitors, but you're very right. I mean, we're in a very good spot in Australia now. Obviously, wasn't as good 3-4 months ago, but
yeah,
where
sure.
We're at now, we have the capacity to compete week in, week out. There's a competition in Melbourne twice a week. It's huge. So we're now in a position where we're at a very big advantage over a lot of countries in the most non-equitable way possible, because I'm not sure what the IOC are going to do about that, because I feel there may be a change come qualification standards in how they're going to actually allow people to qualify for the Olympics. Because at the moment, the system will actually be top 5 performances, and I don't see a lot of these guys getting the ability to put in 5 performances. So that may be another change coming up over the next few months.
Now, I've always wanted to ask an Olympic athlete this, and now we've asked some serious questions, and this is not going to fall into one of those ones they're going to carve into stone and ask in 100 years' time, but I'm never going to get a chance to ask than I am right now. Jack, when did you know you were really fast? Were you 4 and 5 and just beating the older kids at the park, or was it when you started to do athletics? When did you realise that you were not just quick, you were super quick?
No, it's actually funny, because I was never really that quick. When I won my first state title at 14 years old, where I ran 11.8 seconds over the 100, and then a year and 4 months later, I ran 10.4. So I think that sort of 15-metre difference over the 100 metres is when I first knew I was moving well.
So you're telling us there's some kids over there in Tassie or the like who were saying, oh, I used to beat Jack Hale, I tell you.
There was a few, don't you?
I bet not many.
That'd be a good pub story. Well, Jack, you speak so well, and you've really endeared yourself to the RSN family as well by telling us how you put on 12 kilos after relocating. I think there's a lot of people that are just nodding, saying, yeah, I can see how that happened. Admittedly, you've probably done it quite differently to what a lot of us would have done. But, Jack, we really appreciate having a chat. You speak so brilliantly, and best of luck, hopefully, at the Tokyo Olympics, wherever that may be.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Welcome back to RSN. Nick Quinn and Glenn McFarlane. Send us a text on 0416 90 50 52 to get involved with the show. And we're going to take a chat now to Jackson Hatley from the Adelaide Crows. I can say from the Adelaide Crows. Previously, I would have said with GWS, but the Crows, they've got him back home, and I'm sure he's very pumped about that. Jackson, thanks for having a chat today.
Thanks for having me, guys. Absolutely. I'm stoked to be back. And, It's been amazing, man, being back and being with the new group. So, it's something that I'm excited to continue to work with the boys with.
Did you grow up barracking for the Crows?
I didn't, actually. I was actually a Collingwood fan growing up, surprisingly. My old man was was into the Pies, so I had no choice but to be back in my home state playing for, you know, a big club in South Australia is something that I'm super pumped with.
Jackson, you played the 13 games across the two seasons with six last year. How much was the move about wanting to get back to your home state, or how much was it more about actually the opportunity to play, you know, in that midfield at the Crows?
Yeah, I think there's never, you know, only one factor in any sort of decision that you make. So, you know, both of those things were definitely factors that I considered, and that opportunity was a really, really big one for me. You know, being at the Giants for a bit and not quite being able to crack in that midfield. And so that was, you know, probably the biggest factor. But then, you know, the fact that I'm playing for my home state now, you know, that was something that I didn't take for granted either, or take lightly. So, you know, those two things were huge in me coming to the club.
And I think the Crows were talking to you about 6 weeks out from the end of that season. And Matthew Nix must have played a big role in that. You had one season with Matthew when he was obviously that senior assistant at the Giants. What sort of impact has he made on you in that time, but also now going forward?
Yeah, Nix, he was someone I had a lot of respect for in my year at the Giants. And, you know, I just loved the way he went about it. I was just sure he was going to be a senior coach during that first year. He just had that vibe about him, and you know, he was big in my decision as well. He was definitely another factor, and yeah, I've been, you know, super impressed again coming back, and you know, love the way he's running the sessions, and you know, the focus he's putting on, you know, putting others first, and you know, supporting others, and yeah, I've been super impressed with him again.
Jackson, you played in South Australia in 2018 in the Central Districts before going across to the Giants. Obviously, it's very different the way that the locals treat their footy in South Australia compared to what you would have experienced over in Greater Western Sydney the past 2 years. Do you think that'll help you when you get back to Adelaide to play at the AFL level, knowing the passion, having grown up in South Australia and having had that year at Central Districts?
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, growing up here, you know how much of a footy state it is, and you know, how much everyone's passionate about it and cares for it. And, you know, there's no other fans that you'd rather play in front of than the fans that are really passionate about it. So, yeah, I know as a club, you know, we just want to play a brand of footy that's going to make those passionate supporters proud. And so, you know, that's going to be our focus throughout the year.
And walking away from the Giants, what were your impressions of the fans and how football was regarded in that part of the world?
I think it's definitely growing, and you know, the Giants have done a good job over there, and you know, they started themselves from the bottom essentially, and had to, you know, build a fan base, and I think, you know, the Giants have done and are still doing a really good job in that space. So you know, I've got to give it to them, give it to them there. But I think, you know, that strong culture that South Australian footy has, you know, something that's pretty hard to find elsewhere.
It's a big effort for the Crows to be able to get you for free as well, which is outstanding for them. How disappointed were you initially that the trade couldn't be done early? And, you know, I think you obviously always knew you were going to go to the Crows, but were you disappointed that the two clubs couldn't get a deal done early?
I was, myself personally, you know, I knew it was going to happen, and that they had that pick there, so it was more just a frustration thing about the time and making it official. But you know, ideally a deal would have got done between the two clubs, but you know, it's in the past now, and it didn't happen. And so for the Crows to have that you know, that pre-season pick worked out really well, and you know, everything's worked out the same, so I'm pumped with it.
How anxious do you get during that period with the high level of uncertainty, though, about when it's going to happen, if it doesn't happen, if it falls through? Were you thinking, oh, gee, this might happen, this might not happen? Or do you just have faith it will work itself out, and if it doesn't, you cross that bridge when you get to it?
Yeah, no, I'm pretty relaxed, sort of operated, but it definitely does. Sometimes, you know, test you, that it's pretty hectic, that last hour of trade period, and you know, you're hearing things, and you know, these potential deals might happen, and all of this. But you know, like I said, I knew they had that pick one in the preseason draft, so I was feeling quite relaxed the whole time, and it worked out.
And do you think the Crows can actually surprise a few people in 2021? Obviously, it took a while for them to get going, but when they did, they really showed some stuff as well late in the season.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, you don't want to put any limits on yourself. And that's for everyone. And, like I said before, the focus for the club is just to play, you know, a brand of footy that we're super proud of and that the fans can be super proud of. And, you don't want to put any limits on yourself in terms of wins and losses or anything. We're just going to go out there and, try and do that and, play footy that we're proud of and our fans are proud of.
Do you know any of the players from previously playing in South Australia going back to the Crows? And if not, have there been one or two players that have reached out to you to really welcome you back to the club?
I knew Wayne Malira a little bit. He was a Central District junior as well. So I'd watched him a little bit. He was a few years older than me and then caught up a couple of times. So he's been a great one. And I also knew Ned McHenry and Chase Jones from the AFL Academy. Those two have been two really good ones there. They're my draft year as well. So it was really good to, be back in a playing group with those guys.
And any of the boys reached out to you, gone for a coffee or maybe a beer if you're allowed to, and just said, welcome to the club and this is how we're going to do things?
Oh, all the boys have been exceptional in that regard. I've been training with them, the group for a little bit now, and Tommy Lynch has been a really big one. He's great in welcoming guys to the club, and he's welcoming with open arms. Roy Sloan been unbelievable too. Tex, there's some good leaders at the club, and they definitely go about it the right way.
Well, you'll definitely learn a lot out of that inside mid role from Rory Sloan and Matty Crouch and that as well. Just on Taylor Walker, we're all obsessed with him over here. He's an unusual cat. Have you got any unusual stories in your brief time at the Crows from the great man?
Oh, I don't have any unusual ones yet. Maybe
they're coming.
I've heard they're coming, but Texas, he's a ripper. I know he can definitely be light-hearted and have a joke off the field, which everyone loves. He puts in the work as much as anyone. And, he's an outstanding leader, and I've been super impressed from what I've seen with him.
Well, Jackson, we've been super impressed with you from this interview. We wish you nothing but good things at Adelaide in 2021. Well done on getting to the Crows, and best of luck.
Appreciate it, boys. Thanks for having me.
And we're ready to chat to the star from Melbourne City, Curtis Good. City haven't played at home in 300 games. That will change Saturday night. How good is it, Curtis, to be back on your home deck?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. It's been a while. It's sort of, it feels a bit surreal to be back. So, over the moon, the boys are pumped. It's been an exciting week of training. So, happy to be back in front of the fans.
Now, this will be City's third game for the season. Started with a really good win over Brisbane. A game where the score probably wasn't indicative of the dominance, but then, unfortunately, a little bit lacklustre against Adelaide, losing 2-0. Did the little freshen up and the little break between games come at a good time so you could just get back on track after that defeat?
As a team, collectively, I think was good timing, more to reset tactically. From a personal perspective and the boys' perspective, I guess, it's after a loss like that, you want to be back at it sort of straight away. So makes the boys more hungry, having more time off and, I wouldn't say time off, but time away from actual competitive matches. So boys are eager to go and eager to make it right, I guess.
Curtis, congratulations on the new 3-year extension to stay at City. This club clearly means a lot to you.
Two reasons, actually. One being that when I started a professional career, and the second reason being it was the only team that would give me a look in a few years or so after my injury problem. So thankful for the staff and for the physios and that for getting me right and sort of letting me play football again, which I'm very thankful for. So over the moon to be staying.
You had so many injury issues and you had to overcome them. What have you had to change with your game, and what have they done from you to you in a physical sense to produce the great football you're doing at the moment?
I suppose when I was younger, I was a lot, very naive, I guess. I wasn't didn't take care of my body the way I should have, so sort of stripped it back, went back to basics, and had to do a lot more things off the field, which when you're younger, you think you're invincible. So, they got me into an extras and doing the important work, and sort of paid off now. I've got my body in a position where I can play games week in, week out, and have no repercussions from that. So, a lot of credit goes to the club.
Now, we like to go back down memory lane, and you achieved, I dare say, every young footballer's dream in this country in March of 2014 by getting the call up to the Socceroos and playing in a friendly against Ecuador. Is that a lead-up you look back on fondly because it was so exciting, and a day which you probably look back with a tinge of regret because you did suffer such a nasty hip injury?
I remember it being pretty special. I mean, it's hard looking back on it now, as you said, because it's sort of split between two halves, the first half being my debut for my country, which was unbelievable, and the second half being the injury that came from it. But the weekend was very, very exciting. My family flew over, so it was very, at the time, I was, sort of just stunned by it all, and it was be playing with players that you've watched, like Tim Cahill and that, and being next to them in the change room and having that opportunity was unreal. And it sort of gives you the hunger to get back there, so it's been quite a while now, so hopefully down the track, get another opportunity.
So that was my next question. Is that an aim you've set yourself to get another opportunity for the Socceroos? We're having a chat to Graham Arnold in about half an hour. We can put in a good word.
I'd appreciate that. I mean, since that day, obviously, you always keep the drive and the hunger. And now I've put myself, my body in a position where I can stay fit and I can start to improve my football as opposed to just try and get on the park. So, it's definitely on the radar from a personal note. So, if you put in a good word, that'd be great.
Did you have to speak to any psychiatrists or anything after the injury where you could look back on that Australian game positively and you didn't look back and that triggered some negative emotions, which as a sportsman you certainly don't want at the best of times?
I did actually. It wasn't so much the game itself. It was more just the injury afterwards was more about creating that self-belief. I still like to... When I think about Australia game, it's mostly positive for me, especially the feeling of hearing the national anthem and all that build up before the game. It was more afterwards. There was other instances where I sort of fell back to square one. So that was the biggest hurdle, sort of getting that trust back in your body where you can say, like, I can go out and perform and not worry about this in the back of my mind. I can just focus on the game, focus on doing my part for the team.
No Scotty Jamieson this week, an RSN favourite, red carded. Who steps up as leader in defence?
It's one of those where we'll have to pull together, I guess. Jamo's a massive loss for us. He's a leader, which is been fantastic for the young boys and even myself. So it's one of those where I guess all the senior boys have to pull together and sort of take that responsibility.
Curtis, this is the first time you're coming up against United since that 2-0 semi-final victory in the finals last year or last season. How many times have you watched the replay and the lead up to that? And is there something that you did really well during that game that you want to replicate on Saturday night?
I actually haven't watched the replay. We've watched bits and cuts from our video sessions to see what we've done well. But we have done well against Western United in the past. I think we've played them four times last season for four wins maybe, or was it three? And it's something where even in this season we've done well against them, but we have to trust the process and continue what we're doing. We'll be down to, obviously, Demo's not playing this week, and a couple other boys are missing. So one of the things where you can't get complacent, you can't get just because you've beaten teams in the past doesn't mean it's going to be easy this time. So we're expecting a really tough game, difficult game, and we have to be prepared.
The City had a great 2020 in so many different ways. Where do you think as a group you've actually got better for 2021?
I think it's been sort of carrying on that collective sort of team culture that we sort of built in the hub. I mean, even before that, we sort of, the turnover from the season before sort of playing group was quite large, and that's never something that's great for a team. So this year we've managed to hold on to the core group and sort of carrying over those values, carrying over sort of the tactical side of it as well, what Eric started, and now TK's implementing. So it's one of the things where we're coming to the season building a morale as opposed to sort of a soft reset, which is always fantastic as a playing group.
Well, Curtis, it's great to see you playing so well again, and hopefully your team can carry on your winning ways and continue this dominance over United on Saturday night. Tickets still available, so hopefully a massive crowd. Best of luck.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Big thrill now to speak to one of the superstars in the history of the round ball code in Australia, Graham Arnold, a man synonymous with Australian success who has a chat to us now. Graham, thank you for joining us, and it's with a tinge of sadness as well, because it's been a sad week for Australian football with the passing of Frank Arok, a legend and a Socceroos great.
Yeah, thanks, guys. And, yeah, obviously it was sad to get a text message late on Tuesday night about Frank. You know, I have to say, he was probably, you know, one of the reasons why I ended up having a great career and a great life was because he was a coach that really believed in younger players, and he was probably ahead of his time here in Australia. And if you remember back to the mid-'80s, he was a guy who was coaching a Socceroo A team, a Socceroo B team, which was predominantly, you know, the younger players like myself and Farina and that, and then coaching St. George Budapest all at the same time. And you know, it was only a couple of months ago that I spoke to him by Zoom, on a Zoom meeting, when he was in a old people's home over in Yugoslavia, and he still seemed to have his wits about him and everything about him. But yeah, as you said, it was extremely sad to see probably one of the most passionate coaches, and if there's something that I've taken out of taken into my coaching that I got off Frank Arok, was just, you know, it is a passion of the game and the passion of coaching and helping kids and helping players.
Yeah, he's left an amazing legacy for Australian football, but also an amazing life story in himself as well. So, Graham, we spoke to you in late 2019 and you outlined the massive year that you had planned. Mm. Obviously, COVID got in the way of everything. How did you get through the year in terms of looking forward to the future, a future that's still a little uncertain?
Yeah, well, this time last year we were in you know, we're in Thailand with the Oli Roos and qualifying for the Olympics, and we had a massive program, as you said, on the calendar. But look, this is just something that's not anyone's fault in any way of cancelling any. Everything's just been postponed, and everyone is going through extremely difficult times, and big businesses and a lot of people are doing that. So we've just got to make sure that we support and get that all right. But on the football side of it, it's been a bit frustrating. But for me, I've used that time to sort of say, look, well, this could be half time in my career. And that's how I'm dealing with it mentally, and improving on what I can do and improve on things for myself. And that is, I've been looking at really working and reading about how the brain works and the mental side of the game, the mental side of players, and the effect that social media and those type of things has on individuals and on the performance of players. So I've been working, looking at, again, doing that. And then I've been working with FFA, and, you know, well, the day that it happened, you know, it was pretty much straight away as soon as we got back from Thailand. And know, when I went to Thailand with the Ollie Roo boys, I had trouble picking the squad because we didn't have that many players. We didn't have the numbers playing here in Australia. So it took me 3 months with my two analysts to do a document for FFA with no opinion based. It was all data. It was all stats on the lack of development and the lack of opportunities for kids in this country to play the game and become great players like we had with the Golden Generation. And so I've been doing a lot of work with that and a lot of work with the state federations all around Australia to change their views of thinking about what's our identity, what are we here for, and we're here to help kids and we're here to help the game. And, you know, as I said, it's, you know, for a long time, kids haven't come through the system and looking at why. And I think just quickly to sum that up for you is it's probably mainly two things. One is the kids don't, there's not enough football in this country. A-League, 26 rounds. Well, it should be probably 33 rounds. NPL, state feds, 22 rounds. Well, it should be 34 rounds. NYL, 8 rounds. The National Youth League, 8 rounds. Now, how can you get great at your trade if you're playing 8 games a season? So that's one thing, is the lack of minutes played. And the other thing is we seem to have a cut-off age here in Australia of 20 years of age. If a kid's not good enough by 20, he doesn't get through the system. So raising that to an age of under 23 was quite, is what I looked at. And the A-League clubs have done that, and the state federations are buying into that as well.
Graham, obviously there's so much uncertainty at the moment, but what's the latest with the World Cup qualifiers? Because I dare say there's a bit of a backlog of those games. And the Copa America, is there a chance that will go ahead, and will Australia be involved?
Yeah, look, it's we have to plan that everyone's going to go ahead, and it's the same as Tokyo. You know, we have to plan and be ready for that to happen. If we just think that it's not going to happen, then all of a sudden it does happen, well then, you know, we'll get surprised and we our preparation won't be right. So we're preparing that everything is going ahead at this moment. March, we need government help. I have to be honest, we need government help to get to be able to play here in Australia against Kuwait, to get our players that are all overseas back into Australia, to be able to get tested at the airport, go to the hotel, train for 3 days and play, and then be able to go back out. If we can't get that type of help from the government, well then, you know, it will be difficult for this whole year. But we're preparing to play Kuwait on the 25th of March here in Australia, and then we're playing Nepal on the 30th. March in Nepal. Every day it all changes, but as I said, I'm planning that everything's going ahead, and then we've got two games in June, and this could all be the Copa America could just be affected, if anything, by if nothing happens in March, because FIFA have put a FIFA window from June 1 to June 15 to get the World Cup, that second phase of World Cup qualifiers finished. If not, then, you know, well, then Copa America, our first game, is meant to be on the 12th of June. So it's one step at a time. It's, the Copa America is a great experience for everyone to be able to go and play or to watch. But, you know, the most important thing for all of us is the World Cup qualifiers, and we've got to make sure we don't put that in jeopardy at all.
Yeah, you make some great points about the uncertainty and uncertain parts that are across the world. And how difficult has it been, and what advice have you given to, you know, the Socceroos and the younger players struggling for that continuity that they usually get and the minutes that they're not getting around the world at the moment?
Yeah, that's it. And every country is different and dealing with it differently. And, Australia's done a great job, obviously, keeping the virus out of this country, and compared to when you look at what's going on in Europe. We've probably had 8 to 10 players that have had it, the coronavirus, and so we've been there to support them and to be there for, you know, obviously, talking to them about how they're feeling that, and, you know, they've got through that because they're fit and healthy and they're young. But, look, we've, for the players overseas and in different countries, it's actually at the moment, except for a couple of players, the boys are playing a lot of minutes in Europe. You know, there's Martin Boyle's doing great in Scotland. It's great to see Jackson Irvine just signed with Hibs. We've got, Danny Vukovic, Lawrence Thomas is doing fantastic in Denmark. So we've got a lot of boys that are playing and playing a lot of minutes, and it's good to see Aziz Bajic has taken one step back to go a step forward, and he's playing every week in Turkey. So it's, you know, it's exciting times ahead. As I said, it's you have to be flexible with your planning. You can't be rigid because everything is getting changed every week.
Arnie, you mentioned how you deal with the players and their social media challenges that unfortunately are presented frequently in 2021. Did that go up an extra level during this period as well? Because a lot of these footballers, they would have had their routine taken away. To some of them, they had their identity taken away because they're just not used to not getting into training a couple of times a week and playing. Were you constantly sending more messages and making more calls just to make sure the guys were handling everything okay?
Yeah, and look, there's one thing that I've probably learned through this is how to use technology better and you know, found out what a Zoom meeting's all about and things like that. So, yeah, no, look, I've been on the computer and on the Zoom meetings to the boys very often. As I said to the boys, nothing's been cancelled. Everything's just been postponed. Nothing's been taken away. And, you know, we're going to have it may feel at the moment that we're not doing too much, but use this part as a moment to really feel the passion and feel, you know, the hunger for the game and what, you know, what a great game it is and what a great job you all have. And, you know, every time you go on the pitch to play, you enjoy every minute because you only have probably 15 years of a lifespan of hopefully 80 years of age or 85 years of age for every individual. You only have 15 years probably as a professional footballer to achieve all the success you can and to enjoy every moment and to be put on that big stage. And I often use the example of, you know, Sir Elton John, he can play the piano till he's 80, but you know, elite sportsmen can't do that. So you have a short part of your life that you're able to do that. So enjoy it, but make sure you work hard, believe strongly in yourself, and go on the pitch, and every game, give 100% and give the best you can.
Arnie, are there one or two players that you can steer us into to potentially follow in the Socceroos jersey over the coming years? Are there one or two players that you're really excited about who are coming through the ranks?
Mate, I'm so excited about this Olympic squad. I say it publicly, and I truly believe that I believe that we will go to Tokyo and we will win a medal for the first time ever. We've got some really good kids coming through. It's just so great to see in the A-League now. I enjoy watching every A-League game to see young Australian kids given the opportunity. The A-League clubs are doing fantastic, giving those kids an opportunity. The games have been great. But to name one or two, you'd have to look at Harry Suter at the moment in Stoke City. He's doing fantastic, playing every week. He'll end up a top Premier League player for sure. You know, Brian McGree's over at Birmingham City. He's getting the taste of it and starting to go forward as well. So, you know, we've got a number of great players that, you know, will come through the ranks. And as I said, I look forward to working with them all.
Graham, we really appreciate you having a chat. Not many countries would be lucky enough to access their international managers. So we really do appreciate your time.
No problem.
Thank you very much. Best of luck for 2021 and well done for all the support you've given the players during such a difficult period.
Tough times, but they're going to be great times ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that.
Graham Arnold there, manager of the Socceroos, is an absolute star and he's been so paramount in the rise and rise of Australian football. I love it. We're going to win a basketball medal. We're going to win a soccer medal. Awesome. It's going to be a great Olympics.
Yep. Just got to get it to happen.
Just got to get there. Jack Hale's going to be there. We're up and about. We're going to take a short break on RSN. Breaking news from the NBA. James Harden is now with the Brooklyn Nets.
Oh, gone.
So that's happened this morning after his interesting post-game interview yesterday. He's now at the Nets. There's a lot that's happened in this trade. It does involve Aussie Dante Exum as well, who it does look like would be at Houston going forward, which I'm not overly thrilled about on his behalf. But to get those thoughts on the trade and maybe how he thought James Harden reacted, Chris Goulding, the Melbourne United star. I don't want to put you under too much pressure, Chris, as we welcome you to the show, but what do you make of the last 24 hours from the NBA with James Harden and that unique press conference and then got the trade he wanted, but probably not something we want to see in the sport of basketball.
Morning, guys. You've put me on the spot here. I've just watched up to that news. But obviously he's been looking for a trade for quite some time. I wasn't sure he was going to land at Brooklyn, but they've obviously got an interesting situation going on with Kyrie Irving as well. So that's going to be intriguing to see how those three players work out, KD, Kyrie, and now James Harden.
They will be able to make a reality TV show about that because... James Harden, well, the thing I liked about him the last couple of weeks is he made me look fit because he certainly wasn't in the best condition, but unfortunately he's got what he wanted and that Brooklyn team is now going to be stacked with talent. And speaking of stacked of talent, Melbourne United going into next season. I think last season it was almost like a horse race that just didn't have much luck at various stages but finished off nicely. It must have been a little bit frustrating at times, few injuries, a little bit of inconsistency, but positive signs towards the end of the season and a lot to like going into the new season.
Yeah, I think last year, you're right, we were too inconsistent, and certainly early on in the season. And once you get to the back end and realise you're in with a shot, you kind of rue those missed chances earlier on. But that's done now, and we've got a new group. You know, we've got some new exciting players. We feel we're in a good spot. And it all starts tomorrow night, which you know, a lot of us are so excited about. It's been a really long time to play a proper game of basketball.
And a boom recruit as well, Scotty Hobson. Some college basketball fans will remember his work at Tennessee and recently over in New Zealand with the Breakers. What do you expect he'll bring to the team and how pumped are you to have him as a new teammate?
Yeah, he's been great so far, Scotty. He's a guy that comes with experience from all over the world and a lot of things on a basketball court. So, you know, I expect some nights he'll be able to score 25, 30 points. Some nights he'll, you know, have so much attention on him that he'll facilitate the basketball and make everyone else vibe a little bit easier. And that's kind of what we're looking for out of everyone. Everyone's really talented and has a high basketball IQ. So we want to help each other out, knowing that, you know, on any given night, anyone can go for 20-odd points.
And Chris, how exciting for the club and for the competition to have access to Jock Long Landale. Sorry about that. Exciting to say, you know, it might be the stepping stone for him to potentially hit an NBA career at some stage.
Yeah, he's definitely an NBA talent, and I think he'll get there. Hopefully it comes off the back of a really strong season with us. He's a guy that's grown up in Melbourne, and been in Europe for a couple of years, having some great seasons. So exciting for him to be back home and, well, hopefully play in front of friends and family if we can get there. It's a really good club. We're a really good club that we feel he can flourish within. And as you said, stepping stone to the NBA, that's his plan.
How much did you pack away to take to Cairns when you were meant to go on a five-day trip that ended up being a lot longer? And is that the way you're going to have to be this year to be flexible and agile through the entire season, hopefully?
Yeah, I think we'll definitely be packing more for our next road trip. A few of the guys have been wearing the same shirt, same shorts for quite some time now. But, yeah, there was a mad rush on about day six to the washing machine. So had to work out a little bit with that. But, you know, that's just part of it, you know. We probably weren't as prepared as we need to be, but going forward, we know that, look, you're going on the road, you're going to play a game, there's a chance you might not come back. So how we deal with that and how we can turn our attention to playing good basketball in the midst of all this craziness is going to be a telling factor.
Chris, you sound quite upbeat and jovial about the uncertainty. Has that been the important thing that the team's focused on, making the best of it, maybe having a joke when you can and not getting down about it and not worrying about something you can't control?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the human part of it comes into play as well, of not knowing when you're going to see your family and the emotions of, you know, guys having wives and small children by themselves back in Melbourne. But at the end of the day, we've got a date when we think we're going to see them again. And, you know, we're very privileged to be basketballers. We get to travel around, get paid to play the game that we love. So, you know, it's a balance. There's emotions that come into it. But for the most part, we're very lucky and we understand we're in a position. And You know, it's not going to do anyone any good if we're walking around sulking and complaining about stuff. So we're trying to attack it. And as I said, the most important thing for us in the next sort of 48 hours, 24 hours, is playing some really good basketball.
Well, Chris, we really appreciate the effort that all the players and everyone involved in the sport is going to keep it continuing and keep everyone entertained during this difficult period. Best of luck against Adelaide tomorrow night in the season opener, and hopefully Melbourne United can have a big season.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Chris, they're the star from Melbourne United. Mackett, you've been an absolute star.
Thank you. Good on you, Quinny. Looking forward to it. Can I read one really quick text as well? Morning, Quinny. Love your work. Saw you on the NFL show the other week. If they hadn't introduced you, I wouldn't have recognised you. About time you got a new photo for the paper. Don't you love that?
So. Yeah, not sure there's any way I can sort of merge that to be a compliment in any capacity.
RSN Summer Breakfast Club.